Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Fucture, the podcast that showcases the innovators of today, yes, those people, who are making the future happen. And of course, making the future happen with me this week is serial tech entrepreneur Sue Fennessy. Sue, you're very welcome. We're just having a little giggle, actually, before we started.
Martin, it's absolutely gorgeous to be speaking with you, as always. Thank you.
Every time I think about our first conversation, I got so excited. I was kind of going, you know, you're one of the few people who, when you're talking, you're instantly enthusiastic and draw other people towards you. You know, your energy is so different to quite a lot of the people that you and I will meet in those areas that we think about as technology, you know, innovation, disruption. And really, you know, why I'd wanted to speak to you for so long. I've been following your career, and we're going to talk about that on the podcast today. But I just also wanted to highlight that you have launched a new company among the many that you have worked on called We Are Eight, which has been described, and I'm going to give you the description here, as a no-hate app and social media platform. Now, to me, that sounds hugely questionable, because if you think about trolling, doxing, cancel culture, pylon, even Elon Musk, just saying, what made you stumble on the notion of a no-hate app?
Do you know, by the way, with that very generous intro, and thank you, Martin, it almost makes me just want to stop there and not say anything. It could all be downhill from here. But it is time. I think we all know deep in our souls that the status quo is broken. And this has been, I've been seeing this and feeling it for 8 years, you know, designing this, not just from a perspective of zero tolerance of hate, but also from security and reimagining the experience that we could have as human beings in a social environment, not just with our friends in a private, beautiful way where we see them, but it's analyzing reimagined algorithms. Should algorithms even exist, actually? Because when I studied them, I actually realized that, by the way, I think the tech companies talk up their brilliance. I'm convinced that they are tools for division that serve their purposes only, to keep us addicted and serving us more ads. So the no hate piece is sort of at the core of creating the world that we want to live in. And by the way, the world that we want to live in, and that, thank God, I'm discovering a lot of people also want to live here together, is much more full of aligned values at its core.
You see, it's really interesting, because when I was chatting to you, we do these roundtable groups and discussions. You're talking to Gen Z, you're talking to Gen Alpha, Millennial. And we would say, what is it you think about tomorrow that's going to be different? And they said, we want tomorrow to be more about collectivist thinking, more collaborative. We're keen to do good. So that was a really interesting phrase they used. But also, and this is what I loved about them, you know, don't call them mugs. They said, but also we want to get paid for doing it. And that's really, I think, one of the essential differences about your app. And I think if you know, can just explain a little more about that, is how, when I'm on it and using it and being part of it and uploading things, I'm actually being rewarded in different ways for my energies and my efforts.
That's right. Because we realize to create the perfectly pure of intention social experience where we see our friends free of algorithms in an environment that's no hate, we removed the ads from the feeds, because ultimately as humans, people are scrolling for 4 to 6 hours a day. And we want to inspire people to get inspired, but scroll less and live more. So by taking the ads out of the feeds, it keeps the entertainment experience pure, the connection with friends pure. And if you tap the little yellow present button,
that's what I've done.
You then see ads when and where you want. So you can watch 2 minutes of ads a day, and every time you watch an ad on your terms, you're actually getting paid micropayments for watching those ads, and donations are going to charity every time you watch an ad.
So that's where the split is. So I'm getting reward plus I guess, the people or associations or alliances that you have made and that I'm potentially agreeing with because I'm on the app anyway, are also getting a reward from it. Now, I found this interesting because I have, again, been writing quite a lot about the future of advertising and the future of how brands do business. And if you think about, for example, the way NFTs are going, you know, you have restaurants like Flyfish Restaurant in New York, where essentially, if I buy an NFT membership token, I can also lease that token to other people and use it to make money for me. There's another company in New York called, I think it's called Together Price, which is, you know, Together Price has got this idea that we've all these subscriptions to different TV services, but we don't watch them all the time. So why can't I lease
out? I love
out?
That.
You see the idea?
But yes,
I think
I
you've
love.
Hit on this. So just putting your business brain on, what do you see? Is that a future will change in terms of how brands could work with customers more effectively?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're talking about a $500 billion media ad market.
Wow.
And the company that I built beforehand tracked all the ad spend around the world. So we were seeing where all the money goes. And the crazy thing that we saw is the most important people, you see that lumascape and you see the cluster of millions of companies in the middle. And the two perfect pieces down the end, one end we have people and the other end we have the brands and the corporations. And they are the ones that want to be connected directly and purely, actually. So what we've built is a connection almost over the top of the lumascape, because the obsession that we had and we worked on for years was, is it possible to deliver Martin a digital ad, get your full attention for up to 2 minutes, and leave you feeling loved, valued, rewarded? And that was our obsession, because if we can do that, then we can shift billions of dollars back to people. And what's fascinating, the experience that takes you from watch the ads on your terms, because you know every time you do, you get valued and donations go to charity. You watch the ad, you answer a couple of questions, which if you did that in any other ad format, it would be annoying. Can you imagine watching a YouTube ad when you're already wanting to push the skip now button and then forcing you to answer questions? You'd think, oh my God, kill me now.
So I'm kind of thinking, and you will have thought about this a lot, because as you're saying this, to me, this sounds like a much better, not just a deal, it's a much better contract between myself and a brand or an app I'm signing up to. And I guess when people like Google set out, or Facebook, and I'm just looking here on my screen and I've got, you know, don't be evil. Do you remember that when Google set out? That
totally.
That was the big core motto. So did you think that they set out to be conniving and evil beneath this carapace? Or do you think they drifted into these things and areas because their ambition to increase revenue outstrip their ambitions to follow good moral and ethical practices? I mean, what's your kind of...
I mean, Google, I think, brings us a lot of good product, right? Google Maps, Google Search. I mean, the reality is I love those Google products. I even love YouTube. And I truly believe they did not set out to do evil. And a lot of what they do is not evil now, in fact, of intention. They bought us a lot of great products, which I love. However, I think when the economic model is not good enough and not thoughtful enough, it skews. And Facebook, another story, remember their opening line was, we're free and always will be. I mean, we've paid a high price for that, right, Martin? And I think Facebook's different because as a social network, their intention initially was so that guys at college could judge women and get dates. And it's become a big manifestation of that. And then they got all the money guys involved. And then they thought, how do we make money? Let's whack ads in there. And so they took TV ads, whacked it in there, started working until they kind of didn't work. So it's taken 30 seconds down to 3 seconds is now, which is a joke anyway. And they haven't been creative or imaginative about the experience. And what we've done really intentionally is create an ecosystem where we've spent years working on a reimagined ad model that serves the people, the planet, charities and the brands, because by the way, 90% of people opt in to watch the ads. We have 100% view through rate, guaranteed 10% click through rate. We did a campaign last week. It got 62% click through rate. I mean, that is just...
I know that's impressive because we run similar ads for our networks. And if you get 5%, 6%, 7%,
You're already off the charts.
Of course you are, yes.
Right? So 0.4% is normal. So I don't think they set out to be evil. I don't even think Zuckerberg, and I was very passionate about, you know, how could those guys let the hate and teen suicide and all the ethical things, and actually how could they be delivering brands such average results and not reimagining it? But the reality is I'm quite thankful now because they have connected 2 billion people on the planet. And now we can evolve to a place where we can inspire them, empower them, and unite people, all while getting little money into their pockets so that they can pay their subscriptions.
So it's fulfilling, I think, that point that those roundtable groups I would speak to were keen on, the collaboration part, the sense of being collectivist in thinking. The other thing which also impressed me about ReArrayed is how it has tapped into this renewed sense of creativity. Because if you think about how MySpace, which is a network a lot of people may no longer remember, but it set out to be a creative opposition to Facebook, which is like a social thing, but I actually can demonstrate my skills and talents. And what I felt about ReArrayed, it really brought me back into that territory where it was slightly beyond TikTok. It did require me, or I think it's asking me, to step into a culture, creativity, conversational mindset where TikTok is a talk at you mindset and attitude. So I'm just wondering some of your thoughts on whether that was the intention or is that how the thing has evolved?
So I love this question, by the way, Martin. So we worked on the ad model, getting it right, worked on social experience, and we've got some exciting things coming out in January that will sort of have that complete. But we've really doubled down on the creator tools, creator collaboration experience and what's possible, because what we realized, and it comes sort of back to economics. I mean, if you think about a world where Facebook are taking $120 billion last year in revenue and not sharing it with people or charities or anyone, 5% of our revenue goes to a creator fund.
Right.
Because what we discovered with creators, whether you're someone like a BBC Earth or whether you're Rio Ferdinand, footballer, or who are an individual, a publisher, everyone is tired of creating for these platforms for free. Everyone is feeling like, you know, we are the largest unpaid workforce in human history. And what's shocking about creators, and there's this beautiful David Bowie clip where he's talking about what it takes to be truly creative. And unfortunately, in the world that we are now, for creators to survive economically in the current world with Insta and TikTok and everything, they have to go and do independent brand deals. Instagram isn't sharing 5% of their revenue with creators. And what that forces them to do is to create content around a product. And so it immediately tarnishes the beautiful creativity. So what we're discovering through the Creator Fund, and this will all be out in February, our creators are creating micro shows, you know, Get Real with Rio. We're having artists, photographers, actors, musicians all collaborate and create in a very different, pure way with each other. Because the essence of creativity, which is what differentiates the human species from every other animal species, is our creativity and our ability to imagine and create things and build things and write music. And I feel that has really not been honored at all in the existing tech.
And I quite like that notion of how you were creating dialogue rather than monologue, which is what really TikTok and I think Twitter, you know, to go back to them, because I kind of having years of done it, shutting it down, realizing, hang on, it is really one way. And if it's the other way, it tends to be negative. And just I wanted to go back to this whole notion of how do you keep hate off the platform or out of the app? How do you ensure that it's going to happen?
So three levels. Firstly, you can't be anonymous. because of the ad model and the way we have validation and checking and everything else, you can't be anonymous. And I think, you know, we all know in digital advertising anyway, it's shocking. I mean, I think on Twitter, what is it, over 20%, 25%. On all these platforms, it's bots and anonymity. So when people have to own themselves, it creates a whole different thing. And then there's three levels. The first is AI, you know, the tools that we're building in to detect words, pattern recognition, all of that, both in posts, video content, images, and comments. The second part is unfortunately quite manual because we have 24-hour always-on moderation across the entire platform. Wow. The other thing that helps that, by the way, is the way that we've structured the two feeds. So on the eighth stage, it's where we've already verified creators. So they're aligned with values in some form across all diverse things.
Good. Yeah.
So we're not just, it's not a free-for-all. It doesn't matter if we have 20% of the current creator, and we've got some amazing people doing amazing things coming up, exclusive content, but that protects it. And then because in the friends feed, which is just my friends, free of algorithms, which feels beautiful, I've now got 60 of my friends in my feed and I'm seeing them when they post. And when there's that sort of level of safety, you know who your friends are. You don't accept them in your friends feed if you don't know who they are. It's like Instagram, TikTok, and WhatsApp had a baby, but in a loved up, happy world.
I was going to say, it's a happy child. You know, we forget that kids can be born happy and enjoy the notion that they've been a product of great parents as well. And I think, I, one of the other things I was impressed with, and maybe it's a small thing for you, but as a journalist, it was quite big to me to look at, because I recognize that currently across the world, our sense of how we report truth and how we challenge it is hugely being attacked. And I just did some research before I came on air, and it was a report that's come out from Freedom House, and they were saying that currently this is the 16th successive year of the decline in democratic values across the planet.
Oh,
okay. There are now 53 countries where there are laws where you can be imprisoned if you report contrary to the government, if you challenge what is essentially fake news, or if you report or write or comment on something that you feel that's out of kilter with what the government wants you to think. So I do know from reading some of the things you've written, you support journalists as well in their fight to bring truth and to shine a light on corrupt practices around the world.
Absolutely, Martin. And the misinformation, the shocking reality that journalists are under attack to that level, and yet Facebook continues to spread fake news and misinformation from people that are not verified or trained in any way. And they push that through the algorithms because that can also keep people scrolling more. Is what's divided the world and damaged our democracies. Have you seen that Carol Cadwalader TED Talk? Everyone should watch that because it just shines a light on how Facebook ads serve to the right people, created the Brexit outcome that we have. I mean,
well, I guess it's a classic filter bubble, isn't it? It's serving us, once it establishes a pattern, it serves us the contents of that pattern and then traps us in to seeing other so-called verifications of what this is. And therefore, if we're not really people who challenge or think or understand the nature of research, we tend to believe what we see. I mean, why shouldn't we in some ways? Why shouldn't television and social media serve up truth and have a system that independently validates claims and not masquerade them as journalism rather
than
an opinion? As we know, is lots of adjectives that sometimes can't be verified or validated or proved.
So, absolutely. And we're going to be creating, like the Golden Eight Halo is a verified creator, we're going to be creating a ring around the profile to verify the journalist. So if you're a verified qualified journalist that's dedicated your life or part of your life to seeking the truth and researching the truth, then it will be on it. we're being damaged by the link between misinformation and then the algorithms is destroying society. It's destroying democracy, but it's also destroying society and lives at every level. And, you know, we can do better than that, Martin.
I think we are. I think we're doing it now. I think you're doing it.
And I've kind you're of doing it with me, my friend.
I'm doing my best to not get too excited because I've got lots of questions. And one of them, when I first spoke, I was thinking, oh gosh, if Sue's from Australia, I was making a guess, are you from Melbourne?
Yes, I am. You are so good.
I was even going to hazard a suburb, but
go on.
I was going to say Collingwood. I was going to say Elmwood. I was thinking maybe not, but
just near Elwood.
Elwood.
Just near Albert Park. Perfect.
I tell you why, because I have a theory, and people hate me when I bring this up in Australia, and I'm just about to go there and give a series of talks. I have this great theory that Melbourne is a thinking, intellectual, cultured, challenging city. And every time I go to Sydney, which I also love, but I end up having meetings where I've got to run with people. They're forever fit, optimistic, happy. And it slightly annoys me because I do like the melancholic, intellectual kind of blue Galois smoke that I see hovering around Melburnian salons. So I just wanted to take you back into your past
and go, okay. And I grew up in North Dandenong, which is not a lovely suburb. It's the heartland. I know it very well.
Yes.
Of hell, but which I'm very grateful for growing up there. But you just painted a picture of those sitting in chairs and bookshops and
Smoking, the debate. Although, Melbourne, I also think the great business colleges like Monash, for example, which I think...
That's where I went. Love Monash.
But I just wanted to kind of think about the fact that I read that when you were 21, so this is like when you probably just graduated, I'm guessing, from people leaving college, you set up one of the largest sponsorship businesses in Asia Pacific. Is that true or is that a piece of fake news I've been reading in somebody's feed?
Do you know the funny thing? Yes, that is true. And God, I look back and think, God, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I actually finished school, went to uni for a year, then came to London actually and worked for a publishing company over here, took a year off, went travelling as all Aussies do. We want to sort of come back to the UK homeland and did that URail pass around Europe, went back to uni. And after that, it just wasn't exciting enough. So I stayed there. I thought, I've only got 13-hour contact hours a week. I can cram in full-time uni and work. So I worked for a radio station and did business and arts and degrees. And then I could see too much broken stuff and thought I need to go out on my own. So I set up my first business. My poor parent, I moved back home and I literally started in my tiny bedroom with the cork board wall and a broken printer that would do the
across. They are so nostalgic and redolent. Yes, absolutely.
And then off we went. Off I went and then hired my first person and then built that up to quite a lot.
So it's interesting because you went up to about 100 people. I'm kind of thinking about the places and countries you went to. And did you have an idea about how to be a business person, or did you know what you wanted? And by knowing what you wanted, you eventually, I guess, bent people's will to your way of thinking, or was it just more organic and just, gosh, I had no idea what I was up to?
Do you know what? It's very funny you say that because I'm grateful that both my beautiful parents are still alive and in their mid-80s. And I actually said to them the other day, because I can't imagine that I knew what I was doing at all, actually. And I feel grateful not just for them, but other people around me who gave me time to sort of coach me. At every stage, people very kindly helped me and clients helped me. And then we won some Nestle business and Andrew Carsley from Nestle, actually, all these people kindly helped, but they didn't do it just out of goodwill. They also did it because we were doing things differently. and really challenging the status quo and coming up with reimagined models for things even then. And I think even the way we looked at the Olympic Games, so we negotiated 9 of the Sydney Olympic partnerships, Telstra, a lot of the big telcos, etc. And I think people have a tendency, everyone was saying they'd come off the back of Atlanta and were doing it all the same way and turning up in Sydney and saying, we did this in Atlanta, we did this in Atlanta, you should hire us. And I actually said, well, I've never been to an Olympic Games. None of us have ever been to an Olympic Games.
Really good opening point. Yeah.
But this is what you could do with the Olympic brand and how you could connect with millions of Australians in a really transformational different way. And we looked at it from a not just an advertising or marketing perspective, but how you could look at it from a business perspective. So we'd always look at how can we go a higher level and build their business at the same time as deepening relationships with customers. And I think the biggest thing for me, the thread through everything, is the obsession between a brand and their values, connecting them with their values, which the Olympics is a beautiful way to do, wrapping a brand around sport, particularly in Australia, but in the UK too. It's sport is a great uniter because people love it so much. Wrap the brand around sport and then use that to connect with people at a very different level, because then you've got something that is greater than selling a product. And that's kind of what makes me sad about the social platforms. They're missing the point of what advertisers can bring, because they can bring not just money that you have to jam to sell product, but they have the power to connect us and to bring us experiences and to do things differently. So that thread of how can we connect a brand and their values emotionally with a human being in a way that ultimately sells more stuff, of course it does, but it deepens that relationship. And that's really been the thread of the 35 years now I think about it, Martin.
Right. So I'm not sure before or after that, you went to China, and I know you did the big deals, and I know you love sport as an Australian. As a gay Irish man, I'm never so certain about sport. Equally, perhaps because I'm gay, I discovered that when you went to China, you also brought Andrew Lloyd Webber and various musicals like Cats to China. Now, for me, that is the dream, to be involved in the world of musicals. How did that happen? What was the? Was it just because it was connected with promotion, or
no,
how did you get
know?
About?
So I went to China and I sold my first business, Double M, moved to China and was in a lift and was hearing all this beautiful music. And it was, you know, so it was in 2000, just after the Olympics. So 2000, I was hearing all this musical theatre, and I was speaking to friends, and there was no musical theatre. There'd never been a musical theatre. And coincidentally, someone I knew introduced me to someone who worked for Cameron McIntosh, who said they've been trying to come in for 10 years. And then really useful group had been trying to come in. And the old model of bringing those things in, you'd get a local promoter, they'd put up the money and they'd take the risk, they'd get all the ticket revenue if it was successful, and that's how it worked. In China, it wasn't that they didn't have the money, it was that they didn't want it to fail as well. And so what we did was we said, look, give us the rights, 6 months, we will underwrite it with sponsorship. So we got BMW and Motorola actually to underwrite it. And then we split the ticket revenues, them, us, and the Chinese government. And so it was a much more collaborative, sustainable model, actually. So we bought a compilation musical in with Andrew Lloyd Webber. So we created a series of DVDs to go with it. So it wasn't just the live theatre that we did in the Shanghai Grand Theatre and the Great Hall of the People, Martin. There was no theatre in Beijing.
Right.
We had a 100-person Australian cast. And actually, the rehearsal in the Great Hall of the People, they decided that they needed to have a meeting there the day of the rehearsal. So we were all chucked out and we had to do the rehearsal in the car park. But it was a magical moment and hearts and minds lit up.
I mean, a great opening. I think what also you've been describing as I've been listening is the key elements that you pick up in your career. So the notion about collaboration, about partnerships, creativity, applying, I guess, a lateral filter to how some people look at solutions and what you think it could be if you think different. So I'm going to take you back to the present now and ask you to forward project into the future with either We Are Eight or with how you think you would like, you know, Sue Fennessy, the disruptor, the entrepreneur, to be in 5 years' time. What are the things that you're feeling now that you will absolutely bring into the flesh and into the light, so to speak, over the next 5 years?
We Are Eight, for me, is a complete ecosystem. So on one side, we have an experience for people that through the content, through the friends connection, through the infrastructure that is just can keep growing. So my goal to have 1 billion people on the planet making positive impact every day in 2 minutes, getting inspired, empowered to do that. We've built this buying engine that is built so that millions of advertisers can book their campaigns and run them in a transparent, sustainable way. And, you know, within 3 years, we're redirecting $100 billion back to people directly. So on a work level, it is, for me, a straight line, as we need to tell the right story so that people come together and see how easy it is. You can dance on TikTok, tweet on Twitter, but change the world on Eight.
Wow. Okay. I'm liking that as a slogan on my t-shirt, which I'm going to sell in the People's Hall in Beijing.
But on a personal level, for me, the thing that, just quickly, the thing I underestimated in an ecosystem where you don't control and take all the money, where you actually share the majority of the money with creators, with people, with charities, with climate projects, the thing that I'm feeling now, because it's all live and happening and we're funding and sharing, is the abundance and the infinite flow of that. So if you give a photographer, if they get an £1,000 grant for their project, they hire other people to help them, and then they create a project that inspires others, and then they collaborate with someone else, and then the charity gets meals to people in need, and that creates dignity, and that da da da. What happens when you share in an ecosystem, it keeps giving, is the reality. And so what excites me is our job is to build the technology so that youth today can fly and change the world, so that creators can create the most imaginative, best projects on the planet, that micro shows can be created, things can be created, and we can come together to solve big problems with collaborative ease in a way that we've never imagined. For me personally, in 3 years, I'd like to go and live on a lake in a hut and have a cup of tea and a little bit of a sleep.
Good. Well, I think in the interim, I'm looking forward to the collaboration and the creativity and the goodness that I think We Are Eight will do and can do and is doing. So, Sue, thank you again for joining the podcast today. That's Sue.
Thank you, Martin.
Fennessy Hugh. You can find more about We Are Eight at www.weareeight.com. That's fairly simple. My name is Martin Raymond. And as always, I call upon you, everybody, to keep looking, keep listening, keep learning, keep disrupting, of course, in Sue's case, and also keep asking what's new and what's next.